color alteration, we'd be concerned. Hello, Gooberhead. Before you okayed this deception, you were given 3 separate studies showing that, indeed, meat shoppers do rely on color. Then there's Ann Beckman, a Washington lobbyist for one of the meat gassers. This goober gaily proclaims that perpetually pink meat won't cover up spoilage because bad meat will have, quote, slime formations and a bulging package. Gosh, Ann, I'd really rather have a clue before the meat turns totally rotten, wouldn't you? John Katsimatidis is goober number 3. Honcho of a grocery chain selling the pink stuff, John has no patience with those who are balking at the trick meat. This is what's going to happen in the meat business, he says flatly. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you consumers would like to have something to say about that, call STOP 802-863-0555. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Find out more at motherjones.com.
And you can find out more about KGNU at our website, which is kgnu.org. It's 8:30. Thanks for tuning in to the Morning Magazine. I'm Shelley Schlender. And drive carefully this morning. We're expecting highs around 38 degrees today, but snowy and slippery weather all day. It should get a little bit clearer over the weekend, with it staying somewhat cool, but snow likely again on Sunday. So drive carefully. Enjoy this last bit of winter. Now here's Connections.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.
And good morning on this very beautiful snowy day here on March 10, 2006. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, here on Connections, and I'm delighted to have with me as my guest today, Honora Foa, the co-founder and creative director of the Joseph Campbell-inspired Mythic Imagination Institute. So, Honora, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Duncan. Nice to be here.
So one of the things I thought we might do here to begin our program, Honora, is to have you give a little bit of background on the origins of the Mythic Imagination Institute, which was co-founded by yourself and Michael Carlin. We'll talk a little bit about your own background and his background and how this came into being. And then let's move into letting people know that this year will be the second annual, or biannual, I should say, Mythic Journeys conference, a great conference of performance and dance and conversation and story and all sorts of interactive possibilities to be held in Atlanta, Georgia in June of this year with an expected participation of over 2,000 people. And people can connect to that, by the way. I'll mention it here at the top of the hour as well, at mythicjourneys.org. That's Mythic Journeys. JOURNEYS.org. And we'll talk more about that. And also this morning we're going to be talking about the very nature of imagination itself and myth and why in our time it's particularly important, this kind of reawakening, we might say, of the power of story, because it is through story that we give our lives not only meaning, but as Joseph Campbell says, you know, what we're looking for is not simply meaning in life. We're looking for the very rapture of being alive. And one way to access that individually and collectively is through the power of story, the power of imagination, and the power of myth. And so with that introduction, Honora, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your own background, maybe dive a little bit into your own biography and maybe what might have happened to you as a child. You know, maybe some incident here spontaneously occurs to you that kind of foretold your life work, which you can tell us about, and how you came to be co-founder and creative director of the Mythic Imagination Institute.
Well, a wonderful introduction to the work. And if we're really going to go with the story that leaps to mind, it actually, there probably are some from my childhood, but what's on my mind and prominent right now is, I think I had mentioned to you last week that my mama died. My mama died about a few weeks ago on the 1st of February, and she's been in my heart and in my feelings a lot. And what leads to mind when you ask me that question is something that happened with her and with me not that long ago, maybe 20 years ago. 20 years ago, my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and her mother had died of cancer at a very early age, at the age of about 43, and the diagnosis for my mom was just absolutely terrifying. She had very bad, I mean, we all have a bad feeling about being diagnosed with cancer, but she just, from her memories, was in great distress. And she began to feel that she was slipping, that just many things could not be brought to bear on her situation, and that she felt like she was losing her mind. And she would say to me, I'm losing myself. I'm losing myself. And I didn't know what to do. I just thought, well, what does that mean? How can you lose yourself? And I tried sort of declarative argument or argument with her by saying things like, well, I love you, and whatever I love is you, and so I'm aiming at something, and therefore there's a you, and therefore you're not lost, which maybe has a kind of logic to it as an argument, but it really wasn't cutting it. And after a while, I realized that in some way for my mother at that time, or maybe really in her whole life, she had not had a strong sense of herself as the protagonist of her life, as the hero of her own story. So I decided that what my mom needed was remedial storytelling, because within the very fabric of how a story is told and in the way we listen to a story, we always are identifying, and we're usually identifying with the hero, that within that way of doing things, that is how we are. That is how we are constructed. We're constructed around stories. That is how we understand things. So I just began to tell my mom stories. I told her story after story. I read her stories, myths and fairy stories and personal stories and regular stories. And it was really interesting because she was in a pretty dark, deep hole. And I didn't know what was happening from this storytelling. But after a while, she began to write stories of her own. And at first they were kind of halting, though they often had very vivid and sometimes really scary images. And she wrote those for a while, and then she joined a class where they were asked to write stories about the Depression and World War II, things she'd lived through. And so she started to write these personal stories, which eventually, with a group of people, were published into two books. And after she started writing that, she started writing poetry. And at the time of her death a few weeks ago, she was a published poet. She had won several literary contests and poetry competitions and had been giving readings. And that was something that had never happened. She had never really done any writing until she had had this illness. One of the things that we talked about when we talked about the stories themselves was how in every story, eventually the hero goes to hell. There is a time in every great story where you have to go through one of these terrible ordeals. And the making of the hero of the story is always within that ordeal, and that is the way she eventually came to understand her struggle with cancer and her direct means of doing it, of working with it, was in story and then eventually images and poetry itself. So that's that picture, I think, is very strongly of a drawing together of many things in my life, that in a moment of desperation, what I turned to was myth and story. And I think the configuration I just talked about is actually, in a funny way, quite similar to what we do at Mythic Imagination and the Mythic Journeys Conference.
Well, what an excellent way to begin our conversation and our dialogue together here, Nora. As it turns out, my own mother died on January 30th, a year ago, 2005. And, of course, it's been very much on my mind and in my psyche and in my heart ever since. And so I'm not only personally very touched by your story, but I see it as a great illuminating story as well, in the sense that what I've found is that even parents our age, or at least the age of my mother, who died at 95 and who did go through the Depression and was born in the early part of the 20th century, they had certain, we might say, value systems and traditional lifestyle that was much less accelerated than it is now in the beginning of the 21st century. And those old stories were, in a sense, being rent. They were being torn apart in a way by the acceleration of the change and transformation happening in society through technology and population explosion and all the rest of it that we're quite familiar with. And recently, Marianne Williamson, in one of her books called The Gift of Change, said that she was talking to her doctor, who was of the, quote, greatest generation, born in the early part of the 20th century, and who'd been in the war, as my father had been, a war hero and so on, and he was of that generation. And she said, Marianne, to her doctor, he said, you know, I'm feeling okay. How are you feeling? He said, oh, I'm okay. And then she said, well, you know what? Underneath it all, I'm actually feeling a lot of anxiety. I'm feeling a concern here that a lot of us are uncertain about the future, we're not really talking about it. And he said, well, I'm glad you said that, because I guess I'm feeling that way too. You know, when I grew up, we always had the sense when there was an ordeal or there was some kind of change that in the end of the day, it would all turn out all right. Mm-hmm. And of course, the great story of the Greatest Generation is that they did have a great challenge in World War II and a simple black and white kind of dichotomy, and the entire nation pulled together as one and other nations as well. And in the end, there was the coming through the ordeal. And I think that sense lasted until, oh, I don't know, maybe within the last decade or so, even when the end of the Cold War came, people seemed to feel, well, okay, now that's over with. But of course, in the present time, if people are facing death, the uncertainty of the present is so strong that I think the power of story is indeed enjoying, we might say, a great renaissance, because it's so needed to the human soul. And what I see myself is that modern culture, and particularly now this accelerated version of it as modern culture and its values, you know, for the last 500 years, and faith in Newtonian physics and so on is beginning to fall apart, and faith in, you know, the kind of spiritual upbringing that many people had in traditional churches is also on the wane. Church attendance is way down in traditional churches, and it's way up in these new mega churches in a kind of neo-traditionalist way. But nonetheless, I think the modern psyche, and the postmodern psyche in particular, is very deconstructed and very fragmented. And the power of story, as has been said by many people, is the power to actually weave together a coherence from seemingly disparate events and disconnected events in one's life. And all of a sudden, if you're telling your own story, you begin to see in the telling a kind of emergence of a coherence and a theme that actually gives what Joseph Campbell was calling that rapturous sense of being alive. It's as if we're calling into being this holistic inner self that's within us, in our soul at all times, but which gets distracted even by modern media and watching television and inundated with this confetti of information every day, to the point where it's very easy, whether you're young or old or of any age, to at any given moment feel, you know, adrift or lost or full of anxiety about what may or may not happen. And as you begin to tell your own story or deeply listen to the story of another's with just attention, and the empathy comes after that, you can experience that sense of coming together. Listen, you're coming together and you're coming together with another, and that establishes a sense of community which is profoundly inspiring. And I think that's exactly at the core of the kind of gatherings that you and the Mythic Imagination Institute are sponsoring every 2 years, the next one coming up in June.
Yeah. The issue of coherence, I think, is primary, and it relates to context. It relates to relationship. If everything is relationship, even science, when we talk about gravity, gravity is about a series of relationships that cause the planets or anything to go in a certain order. There is a certain way. And we need we need some sense of order. It doesn't have to be rigid. In fact, the laws of nature are not rigid. But it, starting at that level of nature, there are relationships and there are right relationships, or there are better or worse ways of relating to any given thing, any object, any other living creature, and then, of course, to people. And it and the story is a simplified form. I think there's an old Chinese saying that something like, see the mountain in the painting, see the painting in the mountain. And that the capacity to frame in, to make something easier for a human being to understand, to see, in the case of the mountain, the beauty of or the textures of, by art, which is simplified. Art is always simplified, and story is a simplified, codified way of speaking. The code is in the images themselves. Very powerful storytellers use strong images, and those images are the same for us inside though as dream images. They have a lot of multivalent meanings. The best stories, the stories that have gone on for thousands and thousands of years, myths, are the stories who are so textured, so layered, they've been handled by so many different hands, and they've both been smoothed down, but also accreted to them a lot of different meanings around one series of images, and each individual image being very strong and then carrying that through a plot. Those are the encoded wisdom that our ancestors have given us. And the reason they encoded it in stories is because stories are what we remember. I can say to you, Duncan, 974, and, you know, if we're talking again in 3 days, you're probably not going to remember 974. When I say to you, Duncan, remember that story about my mom, you're going to remember. Your mind is made that way. My mind is made that way. So in their wisdom, our ancestors, all these human generations, have encoded what they know about life, about nature, about the world, about relationships into the great stories.
And what makes those stories really great is that they are timeless and universal. As you say, they've been put together by many minds, many hands. And we think of stories like Gilgamesh, you know, emerging out of Sumer and the Babylonian past in the West at the very beginning stages of written history. We think of the Bhagavad Gita coming out of Mother India and the great subcontinent and all of these amazing stories. The Bhagavad Gita alone has now over 10,000 profound commentaries that have been written on it in the last several thousand years since it came into being.
Yeah, and what's with this revival of Gilgamesh? I mean, Stephen Mitchell did his Gilgamesh.
Just last year, yes.
Just last year. We are having at Mythic Journeys a Gilgamesh. Charlie Bethel is this wonderful actor who does this one-man show of the Gilgamesh epic. We, you know, once you started looking at it, there another playwright and poet, wonderful poet, David Brendan Hopes, has also written recently a Gilgamesh play, and it's just sort of coming out of the woodwork. And I, you know, not to be simplistic about it, because all of these people started their work a long, long time ago, but, you know, here we are in the cradle of civilization, ancient Sumeria, which is Iraq, and we're over there bashing each other's brains out. And suddenly people want to know the founding stories. And those stories, Gilgamesh and the stories of Inanna, the great goddess of the Sumerian culture, those stories are coming, yes, I think because people are turning their attention geographically and inwardly to that area. But I also think there's just something very profound going on about realizing that we're fighting on the ground where Western civilization as we recognize it began. And suddenly people want to tell those great stories. And it always intrigues me when there's a run on something, you know, that there's suddenly 12 new translations of the Bhagavad Gita or Gilgamesh is coming out.
Exactly. Exactly. And what I think it is the collective unconscious is expressing itself. I think in terms of, we've talked in other contexts about the emergence of the feminine. And that's another theme that's been in your conferences and also that's in the conference of the Alliance for the New Humanity, which we were both at in Puerto Rico in December, and which is an organization that is a partner organization with the Mythic Imagination Institute that you and Michael Carlin are involved with. And I'm thinking in terms of that, that Jung wrote in his book Answer to Job, really the last great book that he wrote, along with Memories, Reflections, and Dreams, he said that the power of the feminine will emerge no matter what civilization tries to do to repress it, because the very nature of consciousness is such that it demands, and I would express it this way, an iconic feminine representation equal in imaginative power to that of the masculine. And in the East, of course, they don't have a problem with that, at least in India, where they have the great myth and story of Shiva Shakti as co-emergent consciousness of the masculine and the feminine that together create everything in the world down to the tiniest particle. And yet here we have our Christian tradition, our Jewish tradition, and our Muslim tradition really dominated by male prophet figures, and we don't have a correlative feminine. And I think that's really at the source of a lot of the struggle that's happening literally on the ground in Iraq. And what Jung's insight was that the very nature of the psyche is such that it will call forth the antidote to any kind of imbalanced consciousness. And if we concentrate now on Iraq, as you do in this conference coming up, you have a whole theme of from Sumer to Iraq. I believe what's happening is just like Inanna went underground to visit her sister, you know, the dark goddess of the underground, Eriskiel, and then came back totally transformed, having been stripped to literally her essence, her marrow, and then came back as a transformed and liberated being, having confronted the shadow element. I think the same thing is true for our civilization in general, that shadow element is being deeply, deeply connected to and confronted on the very same earth that the story of Inanna and Eriskiel came out of, as well as the great story of Gilgamesh, the one who, like our adolescent culture, our Western civilization, you know, that thinks in a sense that it is all-powerful and almost immortal, like an adolescent. It will go on forever, and it controls the world. That was Gilgamesh's psyche before he set out on his great quest to find the secret, the elixir of immortal life. And when he came back from the quest, actually, and realized that the quest itself was futile, he came back with a tremendously renewed vitality and appreciation for the very great city that he had once become bored with and felt that he needed, you know, greater territory within which to expand. So even the essence of the story of Gilgamesh is timeless, that our psyche and our ego-driven, ego-identified identity, you know, has built into it the need to fortify itself, to expand, to try to live forever rather than experiencing the mystery of life and death and rebirth and transformation and uncertainty. And we think now of Deepak Chopra talking about the wisdom of uncertainty and the popularity of the book The Cloud of Unknowing, that mystical text from hundreds of years ago that people are now having to deal with, the experience of transformation and confronting death, death of old values, old experiences, old certainties, literally on a daily basis. And when we seek people to express that crisis too, oftentimes it's like someone who does have cancer who wants to tell their story to a person that's really in fear. They'll literally walk across the street and avoid the sick person who has cancer or AIDS or whatever it is because they don't want to be infected with that kind of potential or the despair that may be associated with the ordeal. And so we turn then, in the absence of human beings, if we don't have them in our environment, to the great figures of myth and story, because they are the archetypal expression of how the human spirit can live through this ordeal of uncertainty and despair and go deeply, deeply down into the darkness, as Inanna did, and emerge not only victorious, but with a much greater wisdom and compassion than when we started out.
Absolutely. The Inanna story is one of the very great stories And it's rare in that it is a feminine, it comes from the feminine side, it comes from the feminine point of view. And a lot of those stories are lost, so that we are very lucky that Samuel Noah Kramer, the Sumerian scholar, and then the storyteller and poet, Diane Volkstein, pulled that story out. That story had not, the Book of Enuma came out about 20 years ago, and until they did that, until Samuel Noah Kramer did the research on it and retranslated, that story hadn't been told in 10,000 years.
The same with Gilgamesh, in a sense. You know, with Stephen Mitchell's translation, it really was not until the 19th century, thousands of years after Gilgamesh, the original story, happened, that it received its first translation in the West. And Stephen, of course, is known as one of the great modern translators of Rilke, the 20th century German poet. And Rilke said, upon encountering the book Gilgamesh, which had not been translated for thousands of years, he said, "Reading Gilgamesh is one of the greatest experiences one can have as a human being."
Yes. Yeah, it's exactly that. And in it, there are all the in those stories are all the details and advice. And we can take that advice very personally. We can take it culturally. We can take it interculturally. A myth works. The reason it is a myth, one of the great stories, is because it has all the layers. But here we are, we're in Iraq, our country is at war with Iraq, and we don't really know exactly what to do. We don't know what to do. We're kind of stuck, and we make suggestions to each other, and it's not like I know what to do. But for me, when I try to look at it from a lot of different points of view, and I go into a story like Inanna, where I think the beginning of that story, of when it's the chapter about her descent, it says something like, "Inanna turned her ear from the great above and put her ear to the earth to listen to the great below," which immediately is signaling to you that here it is, that time in your life when you suddenly say, well, what about death? And what is under there? And everything that, as you say, we cross the street to avoid, suddenly, for some reason, you will not be able to avoid it. So she turns her ear, and she goes down, and the descriptions are just wonderful of what is taken from her at each level of descent. And when she gets down there, her sister, Ereshkigal, they have a conversation, but Ereshkigal basically says, well, you're dead, and hangs her on a meat hook. And she's just hanging on this meat hook. And that's it.
Exactly.
Her for eternity. And that is certainly the experience in a psychological way or in a real way that we often feel, that you're just, that's it. It's over, you're in hell, you're hanging on a meat hook.
Yeah, the deep meaning of hanging out.
Yeah, exactly.
This gives meaning to being hanging out on the mall. You know, if only people could have these stories instead of the advertisements to just go buy some Gap jeans or something, you know.
Yeah. So she's hanging on this meat hook. And luckily, she had the foresight to say to her friend and lady-in-waiting, what's her name, Nimber?
I think something like that, yes.
Yeah, and she had said to her, if I don't come back in 3 days, please come look for me. So Nimber takes the form of a fly, because otherwise she really can't penetrate into the underworld, but she finds the tiniest little crack, and as a fly is able to fly into the underworld. She comes in, she sees, oh my God, Inanna's hanging there on the meat hook, I better do something. And meanwhile, what's going on is that Ereshkigal is rolling on the floor because she's giving birth. She's in labor. And she's rolling on the floor, and she's going, oh, my insides. Oh, my outsides. And so Nimber, the fly on the wall, and the little inner voice starts to moan with her. And Ereshkigal says, Oh, my insides. And Nimber says, oh, my insides. And then she says, oh, my outsides. And Nimber says, oh, my outsides. Eventually, the baby is born. And because of this empathy, that Nimber came to Ereshkigal in her pain and lived through compassion with her during a time of great trial for her. She says, well, what would you like? I'll give you anything. And she says, give me that thing on the meat hook. And that is what enables Inanna to leave that place and begin her rising.
That's so beautifully the way you told that story. Very beautiful insight, because compassion, many people may not know that the word passion actually in its etymology or original meaning means suffering, and compassion means to suffer with, just as, for instance, Job's companions did with him in the book of Job, until they could follow him only to a certain point of orthodoxy, and then Job went beyond them. But it's also the great story of the Grail. When Parsifal comes in to the Grail castle, he knows something's wrong. But the two questions, the one of wisdom, and the one of compassion, are stifled in his throat because he's been told by his mother, in this case representing conventional society, that would-be aspiring knights don't say stupid things. They're silent in the company of authority. And all the courtiers that are there in the mystical Grail palace know that Percival holds the key to actually heal and transform the entire kingdom through healing the king. If only he'll say the two questions. And he doesn't do it the first time in his youth, and he comes back in his middle age after having gone through his own trials and tribulations and been expelled from the castle. He comes back and he says, how can I serve the Grail? In a sense, the question of wisdom. And what ails you, sire? The question of compassion. And here you have Nimber, acting, as you put it so beautifully, compassionately in empathy with this great, fierce, powerful, dark queen of the underworld, who's just stripped her own sister, the queen of the overworld, down to, literally her marrow, and she's hanging flayed, even skinless, on that meat hook. And then she does, in a way, the wisdom question by serving the process, by redeeming Inanna and bringing her back to life, as it were, and above ground, redeemed and transformed. And I think that's so much the key of all of these stories, that unless we can, as Matthew Fox puts it, learn how to pet the dragon rather than slay it, go deep into our own psyche, into the most fearsome, part of the reptilian brain, that fear, fight, flight response, and face our own shadow. And of course, there are multitudinous opportunities for us to do that if we would only, welcome them rather than fleeing from them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, to me, the Grail story could be the story of our time that we need to relate to. Someone I hold very dear, or two people really, are Robert Sardello and his wife and partner, Cheryl Sanders, who founded the School of Spiritual Psychology. Robert's basically one of the founders of archetypal psychology with James Hillman and Thomas Moore. The work that they all did together was very foundational years ago at the Dallas Institute for the Humanities. And then the three of them have gone on to such amazing things. James Hillman was at Mythic Journeys last time and was kind of the godfather of our enterprise. He was very kind to us, very good to us, and guided us in many ways. And this time, Robert Sardello and Cheryl Sanders will be there. And their school, the School of Spiritual Psychology, the founding story that they work with is the Parsifal story, is the Grail story, because it does seem to have a lot of what we need to do now in it. I suppose that throughout time, these qualities have always been needed. But in fact, myth, while there are eternal elements of all myth, they will come up sequentially as more important during a certain time. They will reflect a certain time, just like we were talking about, why are we doing Gilgamesh now? And that particular one, Cheryl and Robert work with in great depth. And I'm very interested to see what they're going to come out with at this year's conference, because they have given me so much by working with that story day after day after day after day and all the different images in it. Cheryl does a section of work that I hope she'll do. We're talking about whether she'll do this at the conference, but it's about the women of the Grail, and she takes all the female characters and speaks about what she calls radical receptivity and how that quality, as you were talking about before, is not even recognized in our culture. I mean, if you don't speak, if you're not out there being proactive all the time, then there's something wrong with you. And the whole concept that receptivity itself is a power, the whole quality of receptivity is not, it's not like you've got this active principle and it's a lightning bolt and you've got this feminine principle that is a bowl. The feminine principle is like an electromagnet. It's a different force. It pulls. So if you don't have that receptivity going on, nothing is circulating. You end up in this dead space because the active energy really isn't being received. And generally speaking, it's my experience, if it's not being received, it's getting madder and madder and blowing itself up like a blowfish. So it's actually inactivating the receptive, if that's a thing to say, by respecting it and really saying, yes, what is that? How do we turn ourselves to that receptive quality like Nimber did? And, but there are many other ways. That's the quality that we are missing in the balance. Maybe let's try that. Let's give it a shot. We've tried everything else.
That's just, it's so well said, and it's such a perfect lead-in to us talking now about the conference itself. And before we do that, I want to announce to our listeners that I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. You're listening to Connections here on KGNU Boulder, 88.5 FM, and KGNU Denver, 1390 AM. I'm speaking with Honora Foa, the co-founder and creative director of the Mythic Imagination Institute, which will be sponsoring its next biannual conference, anticipated to have over 2,000 people and 100 presenters in attendance. And that will be coming up this June in Atlanta, Georgia, from the 7th to the 11th. And you can not only register for that, but find out all sorts of amazing things by going to their website, mythicjourneys.org. Mythic Journeys, JOURNEYS. There are all sorts of ways to connect to the Mythic Imagine Institute in addition to going to this conference, which is in two parts. The first intensity, we might say, of the conference is a 250-person limit, intimate conference with many small groups, with the presenters, and going from Wednesday to Friday. That would be the 7th to the 9th, and then from Friday, the 9th to the 11th, beginning with an opening performance on Friday night and a closing performance on Sunday. There will be a mixture of what one calls the big story every morning, and then there will be the big conversations every afternoon, where the collective intelligence of people will be engaged in a truly dialogue fashion. In fact, I'll be there to be emceeing some of those big conversations myself. I highly recommend this to anybody who's interested in what we're talking about this morning, that at the very least you go to the website mythicjourneys.org and see what's there in terms of the newsletter and many other things that are offered. We've talked about the fact that Robert Sardello and his wife Cheryl Sanderson will be there, but also we might note that Caitlin and John Matthews, very familiar and great writers about the Grail, will be there. Jean Shinoda Bolen will be there this year, known to many of you for her work in elaborating the myth of Inanna in the modern medical context, where she has a wonderful description of how she herself had cancer and went into the hospital and, like Queen Inanna in the myth, was literally stripped of all her dignity and adornments that she had, her PhD, you know, persona in the world. She's a famous writer and so on. It was stripped down to literally her nakedness and put in a hospital gown, and suffered a number of, quote, indignities in the hospital situation necessary to the kind of treatment that she was undergoing. But she said at that time, wouldn't it be interesting if we had people who were trained in myth and story that could actually work with every patient as they're coming into this totally fearsome, alone, sometimes terrifying experience, the threat of death ever present when you have cancer in your body, and we're able to take them on this psychic journey and minister to the psyche in the same way that the nurses and orderlies and the doctors were ministering to the body. And that particular book was a real eye-opener, I think, for many people about how these great stories, like the story of Inanna, could be, you know, integrated into our psyche in a way that would help us in all sorts of crises. Thomas More wrote a book called The Dark Nights of the Soul just 2 years ago, in which he did the same thing and talked about medical situations and other kinds of personal crises, whether they be death or divorce or loss of a home or Katrina or whatever, and how one's own personal story of strife and ordeal can be seen, amplified in what these myths are sometimes called the larger story. And when you see that your own personal story connects to and is embodied in the archetypal larger story, it amplifies your whole sense of your existence, much as Honora talked earlier about her mother seeing a centeredness and a coherence and a meaning in her own story that enabled her to work with the fact that she had cancer in an entirely much more confident and open way. And all of these possibilities will be presented in many ways. Coleman Barks is going to be there, a great favorite here. He's going to be in Boulder, by the way, Coleman Barks, on the 24th at the Unity Church. That's Friday night at 8 o'clock. We've got David Abrams is going to be there, Deepak Chopra, Betty Sue Flowers, the great writer on Joseph Campbell, Michael Mead, that's been on my Living Dialogues program, Sabanfu Somme, also on my Living Dialogues program. In fact, a number of the people that are going to be there have been on that program. Gene Houston, Choang Al Huang, Jean-Paul Wobetaille from Africa, and on it goes. And you, yourself, and we who go, the participants are definitely equally important to any of the presenters, because the whole conference is grounded in the sense that Honora has just talked about of receptivity, deep listening, and then being activated to participate in the expression that is drawn forth from others that are listening with depth and respect and real interactive joy and fun. So that's for the conference. And now we'll go back to our conference here, the dialogue with Honora Foa. We're going to invite your calls here. If you'd like to participate in this dialogue, you can feel free to call 303-442-4242, 303-442-4242, or elsewhere in Colorado outside of the Front Range, 1-800-737-3030, 1-800-737-3030. And a last announcement here, Honora, as we lead back into our dialogue, is that Marianne Williamson, author most recently of The Gift of Change, and who was on Larry King 3 nights ago, actually, upon the death of Dana Reeves, the wife of Christopher Reeves, as speaking, I think, quite brilliantly and wonderfully about the connection between life and death and matter and spirit and how we all have access to both realms. She'll be with me this Sunday here on KGNU, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM, from noon to 1, a special one-hour live conversation with Marianne Williamson 2 days from now, March 12, noon to 1, here on KGNU. And so we might lead into this portion of our dialogue now, Honora Foa, with Marianne Williamson's book, The Gift of Change, where she talks about the paradigm of our time being the move from fear to love. And we could say, in a sense, that really is the fundamental theme of all the great stories. We think of T.S. Eliot's poem, The Wasteland, which is a modern version of the Grail myth. We think of the movement from lack of confidence, uncertainty, the beginning of the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell describes it, you know, hearing the call, refusing the call out of timidity, answering the call, going into the belly of the whale, you know, meeting the challenge, and then emerging confident, with equanimity and great compassion at the end of the story. So perhaps this would be an opportunity to maybe talk about how you evolved this wonderful conference and how unique it is in the structure of it. And it's just not another conference. This is something that has emerged to be in its modality where the medium is the message. It's about dialogue. It's about participation. It's not about passively sitting there and watching, but a really much deeper receptivity being activated in all the participants.
Right. I mean, I think maybe in a way the degradation of receptivity is consuming, is the idea of us, our identity. We're so often referred to as consumers. It always makes me very sad when people use that word. We're not consumers. We're humans. and humans within a great community of beings, of plants and animals and sky and earth, and that sense of ourselves as sort of the great maw that eats all of those other things is not maybe the best way to think about ourselves. It's very important, the images and the stories that we use.
Well, actually, Honora, we could just jump in and say, since we are involved in this sort of making of a great silk cocoon, you know, where we're cocooning literally in our sort of wealth and consumption in the industrial world, it is very much like the consumptive caterpillar that at a certain point begins in its degradation to devolve into the sort of toxic, gooey substance that becomes the seedbed of the butterfly, and emerging out of that toxic, gooey culture that we really feel we're sticky in right now, come what are called imaginal cells. And I love that term because it has the imagination in it, and it has cell, you know, so that it's a kind of circle. It also, you know, to me, if it's called an imaginal disc, as it sometimes is called, it reminds me of how technology and computer disks and imagination and the internet can actually come together in this higher synthesis that ultimately, you know, becomes the butterfly. Because originally, when these imaginal cells appear, they're consumed and just wiped out by the toxicity of the gooey caterpillar consumptive culture. But at a certain point, they keep proliferating because it's the nature of things to create the antidote to the disease. And it keeps coming, and until they start to congregate, and they congregate, and they congregate, get wiped out. And finally, the congregation reaches a tipping point where the butterfly in potential energy begins to emerge and use the toxic goo, in a sense, as its food, its challenge, its opportunity for transformation. And I see very much your conference, the conference of the Mythic Imagination Institute, as an opportunity for, you know, imaginal discs, all of us out there, to get together in an aggregate that is empowering exponentially to our own individual transformation.
That's very much what it's about. The presenters, when you look at the list of the presenters, you could just faint. I mean, it's just incredible what's being gathered there, and that is really wonderful. But I have to tell you that when we put this together, you've asked a little bit about the history, and I'm not going to go into a big story, but really the history of this thing is extremely informal. It's a bunch of people who met and kind of, hey, kids, let's put on a show. It was just like the kind of question Jean Shinoda Bolen asked, you know, wouldn't it be great if there were people in this hospital? This came out of people saying, wouldn't it be great if we got together, just all these really interesting people? I wonder what would happen. And that's really the story. There, we could go into lots of lovely details, but it was really, let's see what will happen. And there was such sweetness, such goodwill, and I mean, when I think about the thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of work that people have volunteered, because we are an all-volunteer organization, we put this on with volunteers, that it was really very interesting to me that in the end, despite all these people who you know their accomplishments, I think what actually happened once we got together was that people in so many ways found each other. That not just the presenters, but the people who came were so interesting, whether they knew anything about myth or not, whether they had sort of had this vague reason, feeling, they didn't even really know why they'd wandered in the door, or other people who were passionately interested and knew every presenter on the list. It really didn't matter. They found each other. And it was just a very startling thing to be part of, and certainly not something that was planned. We didn't really plan in this. We planned the program carefully. We put all our ducks in a row. But what happened took on its own life. And I think that's what happens when you get the idea of an imaginal cell. If we take it away from just the description of the butterfly itself, but go into that word where you take imaginations, where you take possibility and you put it together, that collective intelligence that comes out, one of the most joyous things about it is it will be a surprise, and it will be more than any one of us can imagine on our own, no matter how fancy and special and wonderful we are, it's always better when that co-intelligence really kicks in. Something different happens. And that happened. You know, this is our second one. It's not, who knows what will happen at this one. I'm sure it won't be the same. It will be different. But we try very hard to allow things to happen. We do our planning carefully, but within that planning, we try to leave space for what is trying to come in to come in. It's a trick, and it's not always easy to pull off, and we don't always do it, but it's quite remarkable to see what happens when you put this many interesting people in one room. They are bound to spontaneously combust.
That's right. It's and have the fire of awareness ignited, you know, and it's my own experience of being the MC at a number of conferences like this and at Omega and at the Alliance for the New Humanity that part of my calling, actually, as a, I should say, a vocation, literally, has been to apply exactly those principles whenever I've been asked to bring together, an ordinary panel at a conference and transform it into a dialogic space where the deep listening is present on all parts and the audience, quote-unquote, is every bit as much the essential player as the people on the stage or the ones that are vocalizing. And there's time also for the people that are in the audience, the participants, to actually vocalize with the realization that what gets evoked from us is directly in proportion to the deep listening attention of the people that are in our presence. And we might say that's true virtually as well as physically. You and I are talking right now. You're in Atlanta. I'm in Boulder, Colorado. And we also know that there's an audience listening on the World Wide Web and here in the Front Range of Colorado that is literally evoking as a co-creative presence everything that comes out of my mouth or your mouth during this program. It's unpre-planned, it's combusting as we speak, and it's definitely a co-creation that involves every single person that is in connection here through the airwaves of KGNU and through the Internet. And I might mention that public radio itself is a wonderful phenomenon, particularly as it's realized here at KGNU in Boulder, which I proudly say is one of the very best stations anywhere in the world, and I've traveled greatly, because it is all run by volunteers. There's a small staff of five, but the volunteers are what makes this go, along with the staff, just as it is in the organization of the Mythic Imagination, with a small group of paid staff, and then all of the rest of this magic being brought about by volunteers and supported by donations. And that's the same thing with here at KGNU. We'll have our pledge drive starting here on March 31 for 9 days. And a number of the people will be seeing at your Mythic Journeys Institute will be involved in that through their books that are given to us and so on. And it's just a phenomenon that's happening to take us beyond this kind of postmodern funk. I think, you know, we hear a lot about hip-hop music these days, and my favorite way of looking at that is that, hip could stand for hope, inspiration, and passion, HIP. And you can't hop unless you're hip, and hip-hop has a magic to it. It does give hope, inspiration, and passion to those that resonate with it and from whom it's been evoked. And we saw that on the Academy Awards when Jon Stewart said, that song from Hustle and Flow, it's hard to be a pimp one. He said, well, thank goodness, here's some people who got an award that are really thrilled and delighted to be having an award at the Academy Awards and for whom it's not ho-hum and old hat,
Yeah.
And so, this is a way for all of us together to get hip so we can hop to this next transformational level. And
It's wonderful to be together. And you were talking about your vocation people, you and there are some other people that have been invited who are invited almost as power listeners. I mean, you're a good talker, but your skill in large measure has to do with the ability to really listen. The reason you have something to say has a great deal to do with your capacity to really listen. That as a teacher, in a way, just your presence and the way you do that is a teaching for people. about where the nourishment really lies. What we do at the conference is we sort of have a rhythm going where with the big story and performances, we have a performance or a storytelling, which is kind of a series of images and something real, an experience that we all have together, that we take in together. And then we go through processing and contextualization. So then there are workshops and conversations that bring that stuff together. Then we see another series of performances. And what it allows in the format is for people to do things that you don't normally see them do. This is slightly premature. I'm going to say this because I'm going to say it with the caveat that we're still evolving the program. But one of the things that's probably going to happen on Saturday night is that Coleman Barks and Deepak Chopra are going to, I don't know, jump around on stage together doing poetry and probably talking about time and eternity and synchronicity. But they're going to do poetry. Coleman will do whatever he chooses, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of Rumi. But when we asked Deepak about it, he said, oh, yeah, I want to do that. I want to do Tagore. So it's sort of, you don't usually get to see Deepak Chopra doing poetry, or for that matter, really telling stories or involved with stories. But the idea is to allow people to do both the thing that they're deeply imbued with and that they've worked with a lot, but also to try other things and let another side of it come out, and then we all sort of process together. We process in the conversations. There are workshops, some of which are small, that are more hands-on, that may involve movement or mask-making, or a lot of them will involve talking. Steve Eisenstadt will probably, for instance, Steve Eisenstadt's the president of Pacifica Graduate Institute, where they do that wonderful program in mythology and depth psychology. Steve Eisenstadt will probably do something like dream tending, where he'll just talk about methods that are used in relationship to dream itself and image itself.
He's great. Yes, I know. Yeah, but, Stephen, I just have to interrupt at this moment, this passionate outflow, because all of a sudden we have a passionate inflow of calls here.
Okay.
And we've only got 5 minutes left. And okay. So I do want to make one announcement, and we'll just hustle and flow here.
Okay.
And the first announcement is that someone has called in and wants to know when Coleman Barks is going to be here in Boulder. And once again, that's on March 24 at the Unity Church at 8 p.m. in Boulder. You can call the Unity Church to get more information. So we're going to take our first caller here, Petri. Petri, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to share my own experience, and it was resonating with the Book of Inanna, going into the darkness, and I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis about 3 years ago, and it sent me to the darkness to look at my own darkness, and coming back out with the compassion, much of what you guys were talking about, finding a methodology to be able to look at, you know, maybe what caused the illness. I prior to being diagnosed with MS, I listened to Deepak Chopra and Joseph Campbell. I'd been taking in the information and then faced with a problem that I decided that I had to solve myself, rather than turning to, say, Western medicine to have them solve it for me. I didn't see that they had any clear methods to get me well again. And taking on a methodology of meditation to look at my dark issues, going into the darkness and then emerging. So in the past 3 years, looking at the darkness, and then now I'm able to use my knowledge to help people, and it's in a, you know, I hope to grow on this and become more of service, I guess, to people, to help them.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Petri, and for sharing that story. And now we're really running out of time. We want to get a couple other people on, and
okay. This
is exactly what we want to do, is have people share their stories. And thank you. That was beautiful.
All right. Thank you.
John, are you with us? Hello, John. Let's see. John, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, John. We've only got a couple minutes here, so please share your story. I'd love to have you.
I wanted to share with you that the Bollingen series of Uranus yearbooks had an interesting conference in the early 50s. It's published later, of course, but there, Adolf Portman, who had directorship over the entire conference, reported about how metamorphosis in animals actually at the stage of the butterfly or just previous to it is a very complicated thing. And it's not chaotic at all, and it's not really gooey or sticky. It has a lot to do with glandular systems. And if you read it in a Goethean sense, one can use it as a very nice foundation for the study of
well, beautiful.
In modern science. I wanted to ask, the material on Inanna is different than that on Gilgamesh, and that Gilgamesh was an epic poem. What was the material? Where did it stem from on the Inanna mystery?
And John, before we're going to have to leave, we've got about 15, 20 seconds here. Could you call the station right after this, and I'll be able to give you some more information on that, too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Giselle, are you there?
Hello, good morning.
Yeah, we have about 30 seconds, so if
okay,
you could just
great.
Go ahead.
I wanted to know, and I can call back after the show concludes, I wanted to know what are some of the connections? Are there people in this sphere who are applying these ideas to the urban environment, young people struggling in urban environments?
Okay.
The short answer is absolutely yes. How we can go into that, I'm not quite sure in a minute, but there definitely are, because I think one of the primary foundations of story and myth is that you begin where you are, that story always comes out of place.
And we might just add here, because we do really have to end at this point, that the website mythicjourneys.com right on its home page has something that is geared toward this. There's a section for kids. There are definitely things that are responsive to both these questions, and if you want to connect with them, go to the website mythicjourneys.com where you can .org, mythicjourneys.org, where you can further connect with my guest today, the wonderful Nora Foa, co-founder and co-director of the Mythic Imagination Institute. So, Nora, as we're hustling and flowing out of here, I just want to say what a great time this was together today, and I'm so looking forward to seeing you in Atlanta in June.
Me too. Thank you so much for having me, Duncan.
This is Duncan Campbell, your host for Connections, inviting you to be with us this Sunday from noon to 1 o'clock, live with Marianne Williamson, special program, and also check out the website livingdialogues.com. We're on now to the Morning Sound Alternative.